process, there's a couple of prerequisites that need to be checked before we start manufacturing this custom implant, and that is the combination of the 3D imaging capabilities of a CAT scan with this oral 3D scanner. This is not emitting any kind of X-rays or anything like that. It's just like a regular camera that is right here, and it's using a mirror to be able to image the inside of the mouth, and particularly the alignment of the tooth and the gums, because once these implants are made, there are certain holes that need to be put in the implants to very accurately tell the surgeon where the implant tooth is going to be added, because those holes are where the implant teeth are going to be filled in with. So with that said, now that you've seen this imaging system, of course you're going to see some CAT scans too. Now let's take a closer look at the manufacturing process after the imaging system has been gone through.
Titanium implants have proven so far to be the best type of implant when an implant is necessary in facial reconstruction or cosmetic surgeries. This is due to their strength, biocompatibility, and ability to integrate with bone or osseointegration. However, like any medical procedure, there can be potential complications or issues associated with titanium implants in the face, but they're not 100% free of risks or complications. The biggest inconvenience is that metal is more sensitive to temperature changes, particularly in cold weather, when you may feel that the implant has gotten way colder than the rest of your body temperature, and you would feel it. Over long periods, the implant may also move a bit and cause asymmetry, as rare as it may be, or put a bit too much pressure on the bones around it, can cause deformation. As rare as both these cases may be, there must be a better way to go about these procedures. What if there was a material that could gradually degrade over time and be replaced by your actual bones? That means it can be metal, with all desirable and not so desirable properties that it brings. This is where we delve into the uncharted territory of bioimplants.
In one of the cases where we used these technologies, the patient had a benign mandibular tumor that needed to be removed. First, we performed a surgery virtually in a virtual space and created the surgical guide. We built the guide for the specific location where the pathological bone needed to be cut. We went into the operating room, installed the guide on the patient's jaw, and made the cut exactly where the bone was to be removed. After this stage, we fixed a custom-made patient-specific plate onto the remaining part of the jaw. Because it had been completely pre-designed, even the holes used for the guide matched the holes for the screws on a final prosthetic plate. It fits into place with 100% accuracy, causing no cosmetic damage to the patient, and the contour and shape of the patient's face and jaw are completely preserved. Following this stage and the installation of the plate, using the scans we had previously taken of the patient's teeth, we 3D printed teeth that were identical to the patient's own and delivered them to the patient in the same session, right in the operating room. This means the patient enters the operating room with a tumor, undergoes surgery and reconstruction, including dental reconstruction. The patient comes in with their teeth and leaves the operating room fully reconstructed, with both bone and teeth restored. This is truly one of the most advanced procedures that can be performed using these technologies.
The implants that were explained, the titanium implants that are now being manufactured as customized and PSI, patient-specific implants, are the latest products currently being used in global markets for patients and have resolved many issues. However, the technology of implants, in terms of materials, is related to second-generation biomaterials, and now third- and fourth-generation materials are also entering the market. These are materials that are biodegradable, and, after a certain period, the body decomposes them, allowing natural tissue to replace the materials. The fourth generation even involves the use of living cells or tissues to create materials. Technically, and in terms of using 3D bioprinting technology, we have achieved self-sufficiency in our country, thanks to God, and we are benefiting from the services provided by domestic knowledge-based companies.
The titanium implant that I showed you are considered second-generation implants, the first one being off-the-shelf parts that I mentioned. The third generation is the biodegradable implants that we just talked about. And fourth generation, which is by no means widely used yet, are biomimetic implants. They're still in the research phase, but they essentially involve the same biodegradable implant that we showed you with biomolecules, proteins, or drugs, or other cells that a medical professional may deem to be helpful or necessary for the integration of the implant within the facial structure to be added within the perforation to create a biomimetic implant. Now, these biomimetic implants could help, like I said, a better, faster integration of the implants within the facial structure, but they are by no means yet financially, or rather commercially available yet. So if that actually starts to develop within this facility, we're definitely going to be coming back to check it out. And with that said, we've come to the end of this episode of Iran Tech. Thank you, guys.
movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you. And here with me I have the honor of being with my very dear brother
Muhammad. And assalamu alaikum to everyone listening to us.
Wa alaikum assalam. So how's life going with you, brother?
Great. With my parents, can't be any better.
Oh.
I'm not living with them, but like I have a very good relationship with them, alhamdulillah.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Talking about parents, I just remembered that coming here today made me a bit even feel worse. because there was this problem with my car, and then I asked my dad to fix it. And I can't believe why he could make this mistake. And he just told me to buy something, then we bought it, and then we wanted to fix it, and the car was even worse than before, so I had a kind of argument with him.
That's basically when you realize that your dad is no longer the superhero that you are always
imagining. No, I don't want to. He has to be one.
Well, you see, the parents, I believe that while we grow up, in our different stages in life, I feel that we perceive our parents differently. When we were kids, we saw our parents as superheroes. And they were, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, staying awake in the nights when we were sick.
They were the main characters of our story.
We saw no one except them.
Yeah.
We saw no one except them.
Right.
Staying awake, whenever we feel sick, parents. Whenever we fall down, parents. Whenever we feel an injury, parents. Whenever someone hurts us, parents. Everything was our parents. And so we felt that, okay, there is no one existent for us except for our parents. And I think that stage is a very important stage. And that's why many families that I know, at least, who have had bad experiences with their parents in their early childhood, really feel that their parents are that important. They never really feel that their parents are really superheroes, to be honest.
So who's right? I mean, me with this mindset that my parents should be the know-it-all, they should always be there. Is this concept right? Or the ones that feel like they have to be independent or they shouldn't rely on their parents?
I feel when you're growing and you're maturing and your mindset is developing, your concept of your parents being infallible and superheroes kind of slowly fades away and it becomes natural. Now, where I believe I personally have also made mistakes is that after maturing, you still expect superhero things from them as opposed to accepting them as they are.
Yeah,
not really,
because they are growing up with me as well.
Not only are they growing up, they're interactions with you changes based on your maturity. Like after 7, 8, maybe even 9, when they see that you've grown up, they're not only serving you, they're not only your servants, and you're not the king anymore, they're expecting things from you. They're expecting that you also live up to some of your responsibilities, do some home some chores for the home. And then you realize, up until now, I was the king. I was the queen, if it's a sister, then I was looking after, I was being looked after, I was spoon fed. Why is it now that I have to? Now this kind of slowly fades away, and then you reach the age of further maturity, maybe 12, 13, at least for myself that's how it was. I realized, no, my parents are really not who I expected them to be as superheroes. They make mistakes as well. They become angry as well. They're not always as tolerant as, you know, when the kids are kids. After becoming a parent, that's when you realize this. When kids are kids, you're really tolerant as a parent.
Yeah, but with the case that you explained, I feel there is a need for maturity in children to realize it.
Yeah.
I mean, as a teacher, I'm in touch with lots of teenagers and kids and adults. I mean, I see the process that they grow up.
Exactly.
Like, they come to our classes when they are 7 or 8, and after a few years, we see them, wow, of that person is 12 now.
Exactly.
And I see this change in them. And not all of them have this maturity, have this, let's say not even maturity, this understanding that their expectations should be balanced in a way that parents can realize and understand it. These days, I see many of these new generation kids and teenagers having struggles with their parents just over the expectations. I mean, they grow up, so they expect their parents to be even more supportive.
Exactly, yeah. But you see, the thing is, when you grow up and you see that support fading away, now, what makes things really worse, and alhamdulillah, I personally am not... I'm not, you know, faced with this because my parents are very cohesive. My father and mother, they're very cohesive. May Allah protect them and lengthen their life. They try to avoid their personal conflicts encroaching into our lives. And that is extremely important.
Yeah.
And it really develops that healthy nature in the family. But I've seen many of my friends, and probably I can say most of my friends, they have parents who are conflicting each other. Now, this makes things worse because parents, when they see kids or kids, when they're small, they kind of somehow get together. Right. Even if one is wrong, the other is right.
At least they don't show it.
Exactly. But then the kids is now mature and so on. Then the eyes of the kids are now open. Then he realizes, oh, my father and mother, they fight. They have so many conflicts. Now, this makes things extremely difficult for kids as youths who are growing up. And I myself, although I haven't faced much of these issues, but when I see others going through, I really become grateful. And these are things that we should tackle as youths. We should not be, okay, they're bad and that's it. No. Are you good?
Yeah, that's the thing that I was thinking about right now, that there are two sides, the side of the parents and the side of the kids, say the kids of the family, be it mature or be it the young children of the family. There are two sides, two perspectives. So there is no one person to be blamed, not the parents, neither the kids. But what is the root that will cause all this dilemma, all these problematic situations once the kids grow up and have their expectations? Let's go for a short break and then we're going to explain it.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
All right, so you're listening to the Youth Station, and welcome back to this episode. We're talking about parents and expecting things from parents and what happens when our parents are not based on our expectations. They're no longer the superhero that we expected them to be when we were small. You were explaining, Sister Nahid, you were telling us about what happens in situations of dilemma.
You know, sometimes I feel the root for these kinds of problems as in the parents' behavior. I know in my close relatives, a child who is 7 years old, and since he was like 4 or 3 years old, the parents started to support him with whatever, I mean, literally whatever he needed.
He was the king, basically.
Yeah, and things that were not even appropriate for him. Like, he was 6 years old, and he wanted a laptop, so the parents bought it. Mm-hmm. Then he grew up...
Without any parental controls, of course.
Yeah, and I was just like telling them that this is not suitable for his age if he goes for games that are not suitable. Mm-hmm. I don't know, many scary things that are not suitable for his age, and he sees them and encounters. What if it causes terrors in him? Then they said, no, he wants it, and we have to be supportive. Because in our own childhood, we didn't have these kinds of opportunities.
They misunderstood the supportive part
of
the
parenting. Exactly, so we have to support him. And now he's 7 years old, he has the laptop, he has his own phone.
All the gadgets he can think of.
Anything that he needs. And once we ask him, do you like school? Do you like to study? Everything in life looks meaningless to him.
Oh, wow.
He says, okay, why should I go to school? I don't need to.
I think that really brings up the point of generational gap.
Right.
Especially after 20s and the bloom of internet and everything and the gadgets and the technology, the parents of Gen Zs, as we would call it, they are less technology literate. They do not know they've seen the benefits of technology. They've seen how much a person who can use technology properly, can improve in his life, and maybe
or
excel. But the opposite is not really much, at least in the case of what you mentioned about, you know, that six-year-old child, they haven't seen the opposite as much. So they think that, okay, let me give the laptop, and they probably would be able to look after it. And as a youth, let me be very frank. I also had exactly the same wishes and you know, all sorts of demands from my parents. I need a laptop. I need...
All of us did.
Yeah, we used to use a shared laptop, but then I personally wanted one for myself. I need a phone, and phone is something that my father had a red line with. And I really thank him for that, because I've seen many people, my own friends, my own classmates, my own best friends, my own, you know, colleagues who have, you know, grown up with me from the high school age onwards. Whoever had a phone never really was successful, not in their classes, not in their, you know, lessons and subjects, but also in their life.
Yeah, and the troubles they face.
Exactly, and what happens is that this very liberal form of communication, anyone can now contact anyone without any controls, without... Now, this destroyed the class, basically, this bloom of technology. Though there were a lot of benefits, I do understand that, and I alhamdulillah, I was able to reap a lot of them, but then we need to appreciate the harms that technology brings in our lives, and parents need to understand this as well, just as the youths. Now, what happens when the parents don't realize? What is the responsibility of us as youths? Should we demand and get as much as we can from the parents?
When we're children, we cannot officially. I mean, we normally enjoy new things. So if I was 7 years old, 8 years old, and my parents would have given me something big like a laptop or a phone, I would have been so excited and happy about it. So I think there is a kind of time limitation for us as well.
Would you do that yourself? Would you put time limitations for yourself if your parents didn't do that?
Yes.
Now, let's be honest. Yeah. Would you do that?
Yeah, even thinking as having my own child, I would think like there is the need for this limitation. I mean, for a mobile phone, for example, I had this time limitation of 14 years old at that time. Mm-hmm. And before that, I used to ask them to, I want the phone, and everybody around me is having this phone.
I mean, I've seen adults now who have grown up, who are parents, who are probably in their 30s and 40s. Once they go into Instagram or any TikTok, they can't control it. And it becomes a very big problem in the family. Now, let alone youths. Do you think it's a danger for us as youths that we should... avoid demanding, or should we really go towards that route of demanding and still controlling ourselves?
I think there's a need for education. What is missed here...
For the parents or the youths?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both the parents and the kids, the youth. We need this education. A young person in the society has to know that she or he has to go for some studying. They have to be knowing the dangers that are threatening them. Mm-hmm. Because even if my parents are educated, well-educated, and they know everything, and then there is some point that they cannot monitor the things that I'm doing, the things that I'm searching about on the internet. So there is this need for my own knowledge and my own acknowledgement of the things that I might see, or the way that I have to work with technology. So I think both parties need this education. It's needed for them.
Mm-hmm. And it's expected from both of them to have their own set of controls. As a parent, control your child. And as a youth, you have a life ahead of you. You are a person different from your parent. You are not equal to your parent. You are different. You're separate. You're completely new existent, right? You're not the same person. You're not expected to follow the exact same things that your parents followed, whether it be good or bad. You're supposed to make your own life. So from that lens, being independent from your parent in trying to upbring yourself and putting disciplinary measures for yourself is also extremely important. And I think there's a lot more to discuss with regards to our expectations from our parents.
Yeah, we can talk about it in another episode. And I'm going to mention that still, even talking about this need for education, I'm going to name parents. I mean, the parents are the reasons that kids have to be aware that they have to be educated.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think this brings us to the conclusion of this episode. In the interest of time, we will conclude it. And inshallah, in a future episode, we will definitely talk more about our expectations from the parents. And I think the book is still open, and it will remain open for ages, because parents and children, they will continue to thrive, and they will continue to have problems from generation to generation, and I think discussions are still to be made.
So with the hope to meet you in another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that, inshallah, in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. The students weren't planning on staying inside the embassy. After they went inside the embassy, they discovered documents there showing that the matter was much graver than they had initially thought. This wasn't just about a resolution passed by the US Senate. The US Embassy was a center for conspiracy, plotting, and strategizing to sabotage the revolution. In other words, the US were busy conspiring to implement their plans. The embassy was no longer an embassy. Well, all embassies have centers of information. They gather information about the country where the embassy is located. They collect the data and send it to their own country. There is nothing wrong with that. This wasn't the case with the US embassy. The problem with the US embassy was that it was a place for conspiring against the revolution. They would meet people, provoke people, create organizations, use any remnants of dissatisfaction remaining from the former regime, and if possible, they would rally the army to take action against the revolution. The students understood this. When they realized this, they stayed in the embassy. Now, for one to question, why did they take over the embassy? And to say that our problem with the US arose from that point is an inaccurate statement in my view. First, our problem with the US didn't begin with the event that took place on the 13th of Aban, November 4th, 1979. It began on the 28th of Mordad, 1953. Nation's opposition to the US dates back to that time. Second, the 13th of Aban actually signified the discovery of a plot and a great danger to the revolution. The students discovered this, God bless them. They were able to gather the documents. With great difficulty, they pieced together the documents that had been put through the shredding machine and were able to realize what had been going on inside the embassy. The US couldn't tolerate the revolution. because the revolution had ripped a sweet morsel right out of the U.S.'s throat. Iran had been an unparalleled prize that was in the possession of the U.S. Iran was entirely under the domination and power of the U.S. The U.S. took Iran's oil, they plundered its underground resources, they seized its facilities and its money, they sold whatever goods they wanted to Iran at whatever price they pleased. This was what the situation had been like, and then this was taken away from the U.S.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. Save the palace.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On the slopes of Mount Hermon, Syrians and Palestinians rallied in Beit Jinn near the capital, denouncing repeated Israeli raids and offering condolences to the families shattered by the latest Israeli raid on the village.
They stormed our homes at dawn, terrorizing families with gunfire. We defended ourselves with what we had, inflicting casualties, but their warplanes destroyed entire homes with the residents inside. We appealed to the UN, the Arab nations, and the world, but no one responded.
Protesters marched through the village's narrow streets, condemning the attack that killed 13 people and wounded 25. They said their grief will only strengthen their resolve to remain on their land and stand with the families of the fallen.
I am the father of Mohammed Amin Ibrahim. We see martyrdom in defense of our land as a source of pride and dignity. We fear no one but God. They attacked our homes and our dignity, but we stood our ground because we had to.
The village also celebrated the release of detainee Ali Qasim Hamad, arrested in late June. His return galvanized residents who renewed their rejection of normalization and reaffirmed their commitment to liberating every occupied Syrian and Palestinian territory.
We are here to reject normalization with the Zionists. Every inch of Syria belongs to Syrians, and the Zionist entity has no place here. One day, we will liberate all occupied lands from Syria to Palestine.
In Beit Jinn, grief has transformed into a collective vow of resilience. Locals say the attack may have claimed lives, but it has only strengthened their resolve to defend both their land and their future. Ali Muhammad, Damascus.
Despite heightened U.S. and Israeli pressures on Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance will not give up its only defensive capability. In a televised speech Friday, he emphasized that Hezbollah has no regard for U.S. and Israeli dictates.
We are cooperating with the government, which has taken the diplomatic route to end the aggression, and we are supporting it in its efforts. The U.S. and Israel have no business in dictating how we manage our internal affairs. Whatever we decide in Lebanon or what we do in Lebanon, whether on the issue of arms or other issues, does not concern them. The only framework which needs to be met in dealing with the Israeli enemy is the ceasefire agreement. We have complied, but Israel has not.
The Hezbollah chief said Israel's aggressions have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons. He said the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for the gradual occupation of Lebanon and push for its greater Israel project. Sheikh Qassem warned that if Lebanon concedes, the U.S.-Israeli conditions will not be limited to the issue of arms. Experts believe that while the U.S. and Israel are jointly working on one agenda, they might differ on the means.
One area where they might disagree is in terms of how far to go to eliminate Hezbollah. I think the Israelis would want to do that at all costs. I think for the Americans, at least for some people in the Trump administration, they realize that America has interest in Lebanon. By the way, they're building their biggest embassy in Lebanon. So would all-out chaos serve American interests in the end? If you want to have a big embassy, if you want to be influential in Lebanon, I think you need stability.
The speech coincided with a visit of a delegation of the UN Security Council members who met with Lebanese leaders and stressed the significance of the implementation of UN resolutions. During the meeting, Lebanese President Joseph Aoun urged the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and withdraw from Lebanon. Experts believe UN resolutions are theoretically a framework for peace, while Israel has implemented none.
Basis for peace are these resolutions. They're supposed to be applied. For example, Resolution 242 calls for the withdrawal of the Israelis from the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights and Jerusalem, whereas the Israelis are expanding their occupation in Golan Heights. They are occupying parts of South Lebanon. They occupy Gaza. They are trying to also do an ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. They continue to kidnap a large number of Lebanese in violation of the ceasefire agreement, which is part of the Resolution 1701.
When asked about how the UN can enforce an Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon, the Russian ambassador to the UN told Press TV that he hopes diplomatic efforts can bear fruit.
We can do whatever we can in the Council. But the Council doesn't have military means, of course.
During their meetings with Lebanese leaders, the UN delegation voiced support for stability in Lebanon. President Joseph Aoun stressed that Lebanon has always cooperated with the United Nations, but the main obstacle now, he said, was the Israeli occupation and aggression. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Students have begun returning to the shattered campuses of Gaza's universities, reopening notebox among collapsed lecture halls in another act of defiance against the near-total collapse of the territory's higher education system.
The Islamic University is back to schooling today, sending a strong message of hope and determination. During the genocidal war, the Israeli army has deliberately destroyed most of the university's buildings and facilities. However, for us and for our people, education is a priority despite all the challenges. Now we've managed to reopen engineering, sciences, and nursing sections.
The devastation is perhaps most evident at the Islamic University of Gaza, once the largest academic institution in the territory, where buildings have been reduced to rubble, laboratories destroyed, and libraries set ablaze.
We are back to school again. Despite the challenges and the crises unfolding in every aspect of life, despite the transportation crisis and the lack of possibilities, we insist to continue learning. It is their target to decimate our education systems, but we are here to challenge them.
The students have returned, despite the challenges of lacking learning materials, electricity, and coming on foot from distant areas.
Today marks our first day back after 2 years of genocide. The university lies in ruins, yet we are eager to return and continue the educational journey we began. The challenges are immense, both for the institution and for us as students. We navigate destroyed roads with great difficulty from our displacement areas, but there is a sense of relief in finally reclaiming a normal life.
In the ruins of Gaza's shattered campuses, the act of learning has become an assertion of existence, an insistence that even amid wreckage, an educated future is still worth striving for. Adam Rahim for Gaza City, Palestine.
In a shocking development, Iraq's official newspaper published a set of government decisions, the most notable of which was the freezing of assets belonging to Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemeni's Ansarullah resistance groups, and listing them as a terrorist organization. The Iraqi government quickly issued a statement, through the Prime Minister Mohammed Shia Sudani, denying the decision, while directing an urgent investigation to identify those who were responsible for the mistake.
I believe what happened is a mistake that affects the dignity, will, and conscience of Iraq and Iraqis. Acknowledging the mistake is good, but addressing those responsible, punishing them, and investigating those behind them is necessary. At the same time, there should be vigilance because in the future, there might be greater embarrassment for the government and state, which could harm the reputation of the Iraqi people.
As Sudani affirmed that the Iraqi government is dealing with this error with a full seriousness, stressing that it does not reflect Iraq's real position and that the corrective measures must be taken to fix the course and prevent such mistakes from reappearing in official decisions in the future. Meanwhile, observers believe that this list
may have been an attempt to court the United States.
We were taken by surprise in media and political circles when a decision emerged from the Anti-Money Laundering Committee, formed by the General Secretariat of the Council of Ministers, whose outcomes were published in the official newspaper. Upon verification, it became clear that the decision included placing Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarallah on the terrorism list and freezing their assets. Such a classification contradicts the policy of the Iraqi government, goes against the sentiments and fundamental principles of the Iraqi people, and is inconsistent with the guidance of the religious authorities, which have repeatedly stressed the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause.
The Iraqi Central Bank issued a statement removing Hezbollah and Ansarullah from the list, but a wave of questions has emerged in Iraq about how such incorrect wording made its way into an official document, and as attention turns to the result of the investigation ordered by the Prime Minister, the major question remains: how did these errors reach the official gazette, and what are the potential political implications?
Between denials and political reaction, the most important question remains: was the list issued by the Iraqi government under American pressure following the recent official visit of the U.S. State Department, or was it a mistake as described in the Prime Minister Mohammed Shah Sudani statement? Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
Different in color and culture, but united by a shared agenda of fighting terrorism, military units from Shanghai Cooperation Organization member states participated in Sanand 2025, a five-day joint anti-terrorism exercise hosted by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Grand Force, the northwestern city of Tabriz.
The armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, as a flag bearer in the global fight against terrorism, are proud to host the counterterrorism exercise under the leadership of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is itself the leading force in counterterrorism efforts.
All 10 full members of the SCO, including China, Russia, India, Pakistan, Iran, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, took part in the exercise, which brought together a total of 120 personnel. Observers from SCO dialogue partners such as Oman, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq were also present.
In this exercise, we will conduct simulations of scenarios involving engagement with terrorists using live ammunition. After monitoring the terrorist adversary and engaging step by step up to the moment of decisive contact, the terrorist's route is blocked and they are pushed back. Ultimately, we will carry out an aerial assault using helicopters and heliborne insertion. Hostage rescue and search and rescue operations will also be conducted.
Fighting terrorist groups such as the U.S. and Israeli-backed Jaish al-Adl in the east and the Kurdish militant group PKK in the west have put Iran at the forefront of the fight against terrorism, with the IRGC leading the efforts.
Iran has long-standing and classical experience in counterterrorism. We welcome the sharing of these experiences within the regional anti-terrorist structure. We are now here to witness the implementation of joint exercise plans.
With these kind of drills, member states try to upgrade their capabilities and also to share their knowledge and experience in fighting terrorist groups.
Terrorism knows no borders and requires a joint response. The IRGC brings extensive field experience, having fought Daesh in Iraq and Syria under the leadership of the anti-terror commander, Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
The evolution toward a new global order has made the world's largest group of countries eager to pursue a realistic understanding of terrorism. That is why the SCO member states believe Iran is the right place to prepare against the phenomenon.
We want peace, but peace with sovereignty, peace with equality, peace with freedom. We do not want the peace of slaves, nor do we want the peace of colonies. Never colonies, never slaves.
Nunca!
The statements by the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro Moros are in response to the multiple attacks facing the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro was addressing crowds of his supporters outside the presidential palace in Caracas. He warned that Venezuela will resist any attempt to impose a political change by force. Meanwhile, the national government denounced the theft of Citgo Petroleum Corporation by a U.S. court, together with sectors of the Venezuelan extreme right, as part of an operation to plunder the assets of the Venezuelan people.
La empresa Citgo es un valioso...
Citgo is a valuable asset of Petróleos de Venezuela, which the U.S. government intends to plunder by means of legal proceedings that are clearly contrary to law.
De un procedimiento judicial...
Precisely, the Venezuelan government previously denounced before OPEC that the Trump administration is attempting to provoke regime change in order to seize its assets and oil reserves, the largest in the world. For this reason, the National Assembly defends the national sovereignty over this resource and its industry.
But we in this caucus, all the parliamentarians here are going to vote in favor of this draft agreement because when the homeland is in danger, anything is permitted except not defending it.
The amount of resources that have been plundered from the country cannot be described at this time.
Parliamentarians, in line with the government and its defense of natural resources, approved this draft agreement that condemns the theft from the people, orchestrated by the most radical and submissive opposition, as well as by the United States government and its multiple attacks on the Bolivarian Republic.
From all instances, Venezuela stands resolute to maintain its independence and to preserve its resources. Those are the premises that are the cornerstone of the Bolivarian Revolution and the current policies by the government facing new forms of attacks. Gladys Quesada, Caracas, Venezuela.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Have a very good time. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. In 10th century Cordoba, an Umayyad Islamic dynasty city in Spain with over 70 libraries, the palace library alone had over 60,000 volumes, all written by hand. At the time, the best Latin library in Europe had only 600 parchment books. While the Chinese invested paper sometime before the 2nd century BC, Muslims were the first to mass-produce paper on an intercontinental scale, developing a culture dependent on its abundance. As the price of paper dropped, literacy rose and booksellers and libraries became integral parts of every Muslim city. Like Judaism and Christianity, Islam originated in the Middle East. I'm delighted to unveil what's ahead in this upcoming hour. We begin with Islamic Upbringing Guides Parents with Faith-Based Wisdom. This program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. After that, we'll feature more of our radio productions. Next up, we have The Teacher. Our scholars in the studio will present a comprehensive review of key teachings and concepts in the Islamic and Shia theology and ethical systems.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab, and I'm glad to be your host. Well, in this program, we discuss the topics that are important for parents, for teenagers, for the Islamic upbringing. So we discuss very sensitive topics and very challenging topics, rather. The answers of our guest experts are based on the Holy Book of Quran and the Ahadith from our noble prophet. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified progeny. And also we discuss the narrations from noble imams to support our answers. Well, our guest expert today is Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Brother Liaqat Abbas is a research scholar in the Hawza Ilmi of Qum, who also holds a background in psychology, which makes him a perfect guest for our program. Well, again, a very important topic today. Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, are they historical figures or are they still the lamps of guidance? You know, Brother, when talking of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, for many, they are the names recited in mourning. And unfortunately, like, what if we taught our children to see them as living examples, the revolutionaries, the models of justice and devotion, whose legacy is to be remembered and followed, rather than just, considering them as historical figures meant to be mourning only?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would say, in the past few years this has been focused a lot, that is the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, are the most oppressed people on this planet Earth, and they should be mourned upon, we have to cry upon them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But alhamdulillah, I would say in today's world, after technology is increasing, alhamdulillah, many people are coming to understand, like, are being aware about the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and the characters of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, though it's not to that large extent.
Yeah.
But I would say it has started.
Indeed.
About the awareness of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam.
Like, if you ask me, in our cultures, it was only always the remembrance of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam was only in the Muharram.
Yeah.
Or the hardly in the month of Safar.
Yeah.
And for the 10 months, we never knew them.
Yes,
but
yes.
Now, alhamdulillah, like in the recent years, we have traveled, we realized the Waladats are celebrated, and
yes.
The birthdays,